There was no moon and no sound, except the booming of the surf in the darkness and the whine of the damp wind. Tortuguero Beach extended for more than a mile along the rough Atlantic coast of Costa Rica, but tonight it was no more than a dark strip that merged with a black, starry sky. Julio Menares paused, waiting for his eyes to adjust to the dark. A man can see by starlight if he takes the time. Soon he could make out the palm trees and debris scattered over the dark sand, and the low, scrubby plants whipped by the wind off the ocean. He could just see whitecaps in the churning seas. The ocean, he knew, was filled with sharks. This stretch of the Atlantic coast was bleak and inhospitable. A quarter mile down the beach he saw Manuel, a dark shape hunched beneath the mangroves. He was keeping out of the wind. There was no one else on the beach. Julio started toward him, passing the deep pits dug by the turtles in previous days. This beach was one of the breeding grounds for leatherback turtles, which came up from the ocean in darkness to lay their eggs. The process took most of the night, and the turtles were vulnerable, in the old days to poachers, and now mostly to the jaguars that roamed the beach, black as the night itself. As the newly appointed conservation chief of the region, Julio was well aware that turtles were killed every week along this coast. Tourists helped prevent this. If tourists were walking the beach, the jaguars stayed away. But often the cats came after midnight, when the tourists had gone home to their hotels. It was possible to imagine an evolutionary selection pressure producing some defense against the jaguar. When he was in graduate school in San Juan, he and the other students used to joke about it. Were tourists agents of evolution? Tourists changed everything else about a country. Why not its wildlife? Because if a turtle happened to possess some quality, perhaps a tolerance for flashlights or the ability to make a plaintive, pained mothering sound, if they had something that drew tourists and kept them hanging around into the night, then those turtles would be more likely to survive, and their eggs more likely to survive, and their offspring more likely to survive. Differential survival that resulted from being a tourist attraction. That had been the joke in school, but of course it was theoretically possible, and if what Manuel was telling him was true. Manuel saw him and waved. He stood as Julio approached. "This way," he said, and started down the beach. "You find more than one tonight, Julio?"
"Just one, of that kind I was speaking of."
"Muy bien." They walked down the beach in silence, but they had not gone far, perhaps 100 yards or so, when Julio saw the faint purple glow low to the sand and pulsing slightly.
"That's it. That's it," Manuel said.
She was a female of perhaps 100 kilos, 1.25 meters long. She had characteristic shell plates, about the size of his palm, brownish, streaked with black. She was half buried in the sand, digging a pit at the rear with her flippers. Julio stood over her and watched.
"It starts and stops," Manuel said.
And then it began again. A purple glow that seemed to emanate from within the individual plates of the shell. Some plates did not have the glow and were dark. Some glowed only occasionally. Others glowed each time. Each pulse seemed to last about a second, rising quickly, fading slowly.
"So how many turtles like this have you seen?" Julio said.
"This is the third."
"And this light keeps the jaguars away?"
He continued to watch the soft pulsing. He felt that the quality of the glow was oddly familiar, almost like a firefly, or a glowing bacterium in the surf. Something he had seen before.
"Yes, the jaguars keep their distance."
"Wait a minute," Julio said. "What is this?"
He pointed to the shell, where a pattern of light and dark plates emerged.
"It only happens sometimes."
"But you see it?"
"Yes, I see it."
"It looks like a hexagon."
I don't know. But it is like a symbol, wouldn't you say, of a corporation? Perhaps, yes, it is possible.
What about the other turtles? They show this pattern?
No, each one is different.
So this might be a random pattern that just happens to look like a hexagon.
Yes. Julio, I believe it is. Because you see the image on the shell is not so good. It is not symmetrical.
Even as he spoke, the image faded. The turtle was dark again.
Can you photograph this pattern?
I already have. It is a time exposure without the flash, so there is some blurring. But yes, I have it.
Good, Julio said, because this is a genetic change. Let's review the visitor log and see who might have done this.
Josh!
It was his mother on the phone.
Yes, Mom? I thought you should know. You remember Lois Graham's son, Eric, who was on heroin? There's been a terrible tragedy. He died.
Josh gave a long sigh. He leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes.
How?
In a car crash. But then they did the autopsy or whatever. Eric had a fatal heart attack. He was 21, Josh.
Was it in the family, some congenital thing?
No, Eric's father lives in Switzerland. He's 64. He climbs mountains. And Lois is fine. Of course, she's crushed. We're all crushed.
Josh said nothing.
Things were going so well for Eric. He was off drugs. He had a new job. He'd applied to go back to school in the fall. He was getting bald, was the only thing. People thought he'd had chemo. He'd lost so much hair. And he walked, stooped over. Josh, are you there?
I'm here.
I saw him last week. He looked like an old man.
Josh said nothing.
The family's sitting. You ought to go.
I'll try.
Josh, your brother looks old, too.
I know.
I tried to tell him it was like his father to cheer him up, but Adam just looks so old.
I know.
What's going on? She said. What have you done to him?
What have I done?
Yes, Josh. You gave these people some gene or whatever that spray was, and they're getting old.
Mom, Adam did it to himself. He sucked down the spray himself because he thought it'd get him high.
I wasn't even with him at the time, and you asked me to give the spray to Lois Graham's son. I don't know how you could think such a thing. You called me up. Josh, you're being ridiculous. Why would I call? I don't know anything about your work. You called me and asked where Eric lived, and you asked me not to tell his mother. That's what I remember.
Josh said nothing. He pressed the tips of his fingers against his closed eyes until he saw bright patterns. He wanted to escape. He wanted to leave this office, this company. He wanted none of this to be true.
Mom, he said finally, this could be very serious.
He was thinking that he could go to jail.
Of course it's serious. I'm very frightened now, Josh. What's going to happen? Am I going to lose my son?
I don't know, Mom. I hope not.
I think there's a chance, she said, because I called up the Levines and Scarsdale. They're already old, the two of them, past 60, and they sounded just fine. Helen said she was never feeling better. George is playing a lot of golf.
That's good, he said.
So maybe they're okay.
I think so.
Then maybe Adam will be okay, too.
I really hope so, Mom. I really do. He got off the phone. Of course the Levines were fine. He had sent sterile saline in the spray tubes. They hadn't gotten the gene. He wasn't about to send his experimental genes to some people in New York he didn't know. And if this gave his mother hope, then fine, keep it that way. Because right now, Josh didn't hold out much hope. Not for his brother, and ultimately not for himself. He was going to have to tell Rick Deal, but not now, not right now. Gail Bond's husband, Richard, the investment banker, often worked late entertaining important clients, and none was more important than the American sitting across the table from him now, Barton Williams, the famous Cleveland investor.
"You want a surprise for your wife, Barton?" Richard Bond said. "I believe I have just the thing."
Hunched down over the dinner table, Williams looked up with only slight interest. Barton Williams was 75 and closely resembled a toad. He had a jowly, droopy face with large pores, a broad, flat nose, and bug eyes. His habit of placing his arms flat on the table and resting his chin on his fingers made him look even more like a toad. In fact, he was resting an arthritic neck, since he disliked wearing a brace. He felt it made him look old. He could lie flat on the table as far as Richard Bond was concerned. Williams was old enough and rich enough to do whatever he wanted, and what he had always wanted all his life was women. Despite age and appearance, he continued to have them in prodigious quantities at all times of day. Richard had arranged for several women to drop by the table at the end of the meal. They would be members of his staff dropping off papers for him, or old girlfriends coming by for a kiss and an introduction. A few would be other diners, admirers of the great investor, and so dazzled they had to come and meet him. None of this fooled Barton Williams, but it amused him, and he expected his business partners to go to a little trouble for him. When you were worth $10 billion, people made an effort to keep you happy. That was how it worked. He viewed it as a tribute. Yet at this particular moment, more than anything else, Barton Williams wanted to placate his wife of 40 years. For inexplicable reasons, Evelyn, at age 60, was suddenly dissatisfied with her marriage and with Barton's endless escapades, as she referred to them. A present would help.
"But it better be damn good," Barton said. "She's accustomed to everything. Villas in France, yachts in Sardinia, jewelry from Winston, chefs flown in from Rome for her dog's birthday. That's the problem. I can't buy her off anymore. She's 60 and jaded. I promise you, this present is unique in the world," Richard said. "Your wife loves animals, does she not? Has her own damn zoo right on the property. And she keeps birds? Christ, must be 100. We got finches in the damn sunroom. Chitter all day. She breeds them. And parrots? Every kind. None talk, thank God. She never had much luck with parrots. Her luck is about to change." Barton sighed. "She doesn't want another damn parrot." "She wants this one," Richard said. "It's the only one like it in the world."
"I'm leaving at 6 tomorrow morning," Barton grumbled.
"It'll be waiting on your plane," Richard said.
Rob Bellarmino smiled reassuringly. "Just ignore the cameras," he said to the kids. They had set up in the school library of George Washington High in Silver Spring, Maryland. 3 semicircles of chairs around a central chair where Dr. Bellarmino sat while he talked to the students about the ethical issues of genetics. The TV people had 3 cameras going, one at the back of the room, one at the side, close on Bellarmino, and one facing the kids, to record their expressions of fascination as they heard about the life of a working geneticist at the NIH. According to the show's producer, it was important to show Bellarmino's interaction with the community, and he could not have agreed more. The kids were specially picked to be bright and knowledgeable. He thought it would be fun. He spoke about his background and training for a few minutes, and then took questions. The first one made him pause. "Dr. Bellarmino," a young Asian girl asked,
What is your opinion of that woman in Texas who cloned her dead cat?
In fact, Bellarmino thought the whole dead cat business was ridiculous. He thought it diminished the important work he and others were doing, but he couldn't say that.
Of course, this is a difficult, emotional situation, Bellarmino said diplomatically. We are all fond of our pets, but...
He hesitated. This work was done by a California company called Genetic Savings and Clone, and it was reported that the cost was $50,000.
Do you think it's ethical to clone a pet cat?
The girl asked. As you know, he said, quite a few animals have now been cloned, including sheep, mice, dogs, and cats. So it has become rather unremarkable. One concern is that a cloned animal does not have the same lifespan as a normal animal. Another student said, is it ethical to pay $50,000 to clone a pet when so many people are starving in the world?
Bellarmino groaned inwardly. How was he going to change the subject?
I am not enthusiastic about this procedure, he said, but I would not go so far as to call it unethical.
Isn't it unethical because it makes a climate of normality to clone a human being?
I don't think cloning a pet has any effect on the issues concerning human cloning.
Would it be ethical to clone a human being?
Fortunately, Bellarmino said, that issue is quite far in the future. Today,
I hope we might consider real contemporary issues. We have people who express concerns about genetically modified foods. We have concerns about gene therapy and stem cells, and these are real issues. Do any of you share that concern?
A young boy in the back raised his hand.
Yes?
Do you think it is possible to clone a human being? The boy asked.
Yes, I think it is possible. Not now, but eventually.
When?
I wouldn't want to guess when. Are there any questions on a different subject? Another hand.
Yes? In your opinion, is human cloning unethical?
Again, Bellarmino hesitated. He was acutely aware his response was going to be broadcast on television, and who could know how the network would edit his remarks? They'd probably do their best to make him look as bad as possible. Reporters had a distinct prejudice against people of faith, and his words also carried professional weight because he ran a division of NIH.
You've probably heard a lot about cloning, and most of it is untrue.
Speaking as a scientist, I must admit I see nothing inherently wrong with cloning. I see no moral issue. It is just another genetic procedure. We already have done it with a variety of animals, as I have mentioned. However, I also know that the procedure of cloning has a high failure rate. Many animals die before one is successfully cloned. Clearly, that would be unacceptable for human beings. So for the moment, I regard cloning as a non-problem. Isn't cloning playing God?
I personally wouldn't define the issue that way, he said. If God has made human beings and made the rest of the world, then clearly God has made the tools of genetic engineering. So in that case, God has already made genetic modification available. That is the work of God, not man. And as always, it is up to us to use wisely what God has given us. He felt better after this. It was one of his stock answers.
So is cloning a wise use of what God has given us?
Against his every instinct, he wiped his forehead with the sleeve of his jacket. He hoped they wouldn't use that bit of film, although he was sure they would. Young kids sweat the head of NIH.
Some people think they know what God intends, he said, but I don't believe I know. I don't believe anyone can know that except God. I think anyone who says he knows God's intention is showing a lot of very human ego.
He wanted to glance at his watch, but he didn't. The kids were looking quizzical, not enraptured as he had expected. There's a great range of genetic issues, he said. Let's move on.
Dr. Bellarmino, said a kid to the left, I wanted to ask about antisocial personality disorder. I've read there is a gene for it, and it's associated with violence and crime, sociopathic behavior.
Yes, that's true. The gene appears in about 2% of the population around the world.
What about New Zealand? It is in 30% of the white New Zealand population and 60% of the Maori population.
That's been reported,
but you must be careful. But doesn't that mean violence is hereditary? I mean, shouldn't we be trying to get rid of this gene the way we got rid of smallpox?
Bellarmino paused. He was starting to wonder how many of these kids had parents who worked in Bethesda. He hadn't thought to ask for the names of the kids in advance. But the questions from these kids were too knowledgeable, too relentless. Was one of his many enemies trying to discredit him by using these kids? Was the whole network plan a trap to make him look bad? The first step toward pushing him out of NIH, this was the information age. It was how such things were done today. Arranged to make you look bad, make you look weak, push you to say something foolish, and then watch your words repeated over and over for the next 48 hours on every cable news show and in every newspaper column. Next, have congressmen call for you to retract your statements, clucking tongues, shaking heads. How could he be so insensitive? Was he really suited for the job? Wasn't he really a liability at his post? And then you were out. That was how it was done these days. Now Bellarmino was facing a dangerously loaded question about Maori genetics. Should he say what he really believed and risk being accused of demeaning a downtrodden ethnic minority? Did he mute his comments, but still risk criticism for promoting eugenics? How, actually, could he say anything at all? He decided he couldn't. You know, he said, that's an extremely interesting area of research, but we just don't know enough yet to answer. Next question?
It had been raining all day in southern Sumatra. The jungle floor was wet, the leaves were wet, everything was wet. The video crews from around the world had long since gone on to other assignments. Now Hager was back with only one client, a man named Gorovich, a famous wildlife photographer who had flown in from Tanzania. Gorovich had set up beneath a large ficus tree, unzipped a duffel bag, and removed a nylon mesh sling like a hammock. He set this on the ground carefully, then he brought out a metal case, popped it open, and assembled a rifle.
You know that's illegal, Hager said. This is a preserve.
No shit.
If the rangers come through, you better get that stuff out of sight.
Not a problem. Gorovich charged the compressor, opened the chamber.
How big is this guy?
He's a juvenile, 2 or 3 years old. Maybe 30 kilos. Probably less.
Okay. 10 cc's.
Gorovich pulled a dart out of the case, checked the level, and slipped it into the chamber. Then another, and another. He clicked the chamber closed. He said to Hager,
When was the last time you saw him?
10 days ago.
Where?
Near here.
He comes back? This is his home range?
Seems to be.
Gorovich squinted down the telescopic sight. He swung it in an arc, then up to the sky, then back. Satisfied, he put the gun down.
You got a low enough dose?
Don't worry, Gorovich said.
Also, if he's high in the canopy, you can't shoot, because
I said don't worry.
Gorovich looked at Hager.
I know what I'm doing. Dose is just enough to unsteady him. He'll come down by himself long before he collapses. We may have to track him on the ground for a while.
You've done this before?
Gorovich nodded.
With orangs?
Chimps.
Chimps are different.
Really?
Sarcastic.
The two men fell into an uneasy silence. Gorevich got out a video camera and tripod and set them up. Then a long-range microphone with a one-foot dish, which he clipped to the top of the camera with a mounting pole. It made an ungainly apparatus, but effective, Hager thought. Gorevich squatted on his haunches and stared out at the jungle. The men listened to the sound of the rain and waited. In recent weeks, the talking orangutan had faded from the media. The story had gone the way of other animal reports that didn't prove out. That Arkansas woodpecker nobody could find again, and the 6-foot Congo ape that nobody could locate despite persistent stories by natives, and the giant bat with the 12-foot wingspan that was supposedly seen in the jungles of New Guinea. As far as Gorevich was concerned, the declining interest was ideal, because when the ape was finally rediscovered, media attention would be 10 times greater than it would have been otherwise, especially because Gorevich intended to do more than record the talking ape. He intended to bring it back alive. He zipped his jacket collar tight against the dripping rain, and he waited. It was late in the afternoon and starting to get dark. Gorevich was dozing off when he heard a low, gravelly voice say,
"Hello, Maird."
He opened his eyes. He looked at Hager sitting nearby. Hager shook his head.
"Hello, comment ça va?"
Gorevich looked slowly around.
"Maird, scumbag, espèce de con."
It was a low sound, throaty, like a drunk at a bar.
"Fungalow's dead."
Gorevich turned on the camera. He couldn't tell where the voice was coming from, but he could at least record it. He swung the lens in a slow arc while he watched the microphone levels. Because the mic was directional, he was able to determine that the sound was coming from the south. 9 o'clock from where he was. He squinted through the finder, zoomed in. He could see nothing. The jungle was becoming darker every minute. Hager stood motionless nearby, just watching. Now there was a crashing of branches, and Gorevich glimpsed a shadow as it streaked across the lens. He looked up and saw the shape moving higher and higher, swinging on branches as it went up into the overhead canopy. In a few moments, the orang was 70 feet in the air above them.
"Let's fluk it. That's all whiskey. Fluk."
He took the camera off the tripod, tried to film. It was black. Nothing. Flicked on night vision. He saw nothing but green streaks as the animal moved in and out of the thick foliage. The orang was moving higher and laterally.
"Fluk it, motherfucker."
Nice mouth on him, but the voice was growing fainter. Gorevich realized he had a decision to make, and quickly. He set the camera down and reached for the rifle. He swung it up and sighted down the scope. Military night vision, bright green, very clear. He saw the ape, saw the eyes, glowing white dots. Hager said, "No!" The orang jumped to another tree, suspended in space for an instant. Gorevich fired. He heard the hiss of gas and the thwack of the darts smacking the leaves. "Missed him." He raised the rifle again. "Don't do this! Shut up!" Gorevich sighted, fired. In the trees above, there was a momentary pause in the thrashing sound. "You hit him!" Hager said. Gorevich waited. The crashing of leaves and branches began again. The orang was moving, now almost directly overhead.
"No, I didn't."
Gorevich raised the gun once more. "Yes, you did. If you shoot again..." Gorevich fired. A whoosh of gas near his ear. Then silence. Gorevich lowered the gun and moved to reload it, keeping his eyes on the canopy overhead. He crouched down, flicked open his metal case, and felt for more cartridges. He kept looking upward the whole time. Silence.
"You hit him," Hager said.
"Maybe."
"I know you hit him."
"No, you don't." Gorevich popped 3 more cartridges into the gun. "You don't know that."
"He's not moving. You hit him."
Gorevich took his position,
raised the rifle just in time to see a dark shape come plummeting downward. It was the orang, falling straight down from the canopy more than 150 feet above them. The animal crashed to the ground at Gourevitch's feet, splattering mud. The orang didn't move. Hager swung a flashlight. Three darts protruded from the body, one in the leg, two in the chest. The orang was not moving. The animal's eyes were open, staring upward.
"Great," Hager said. "Great work."
Gourevitch dropped to his knees in the mud, put his mouth over the orang's big lips, and blew air into his lungs to resuscitate him. Six attorneys sat at the long table, all shuffling through papers. It sounded like a windstorm. Rick Deal waited impatiently, biting his lip. Finally, Albert Rodriguez, his head attorney, looked up. "The situation is this," Rodriguez said. "You have good reason, sufficient reason anyway, to believe that Frank Burnett conspired to destroy the cell lines in your possession, so that he could sell them again to some other company."
"Right," Rick said. "Fucking right.
Three courts have ruled that Burnett's cells are your property. You therefore have a right to take them."
"You mean take them again?"
"Correct. Except the guy has gone into hiding." "That is inconvenient, but it does not change the material facts of the situation. You are the owner of the Burnett cell line," Rodriguez said, "wherever those cells may occur."
"Meaning his children? His grandchildren? They probably have the same cells."
"You mean
I can take cells from the kids?"
"The cells are your property," Rodriguez said.
"What if the kids don't agree to let me take them?"
"They may very well not agree, but since the cells are your property, the children don't have any say in the matter."
"We're talking punch biopsies of liver and spleen here," Deal said. "They're not exactly minor procedures."
"They're not exactly major either," Rodriguez said.
"I believe they are ordinary outpatient procedures. Of course, you would have a duty to make sure that the cell extractions were performed by a competent physician. I assume you would."
Deal frowned. "Let me see if I understand. You're telling me I can just grab his kids off the street and haul them to a doctor and remove their cells, whether they like it or not?"
"I am, yes."
"And how," Rick Deal said, "can that be legal?"
"Because they are walking around with cells that are legally yours, hence with stolen property. That's felony, too. Under the law, if you witness a felony being committed, you are entitled to perform a citizen's arrest and take the offender into custody. So if you were to see Burnett's children walking on the street, you could legally arrest them."
"Me, personally?"
"No, no," Rodriguez said. "In these circumstances, one avails oneself of a trained professional, a fugitive recovery agent."
"You mean a bounty hunter?"
"They don't like that term, and neither do we."
"All right. Do you know of a good fugitive recovery agent?"
"We do,"
Rodriguez said.
"Then get him on the phone," Deal said, "right now."
Vasco Borden faced the mirror and reviewed his appearance with a professional eye while he brushed mascara into the graying edges of his goatee. Vasco was a big man, 6'4" and 240, all muscle, 9% body fat. His shaved head and his trimmed black goatee made him look like the devil. One big mother of a devil. He meant to appear intimidating, and he did. He turned to the suitcase on the bed. In it, he had neatly packed a set of coveralls with a Con Ed logo on the breast, a loud plaid sport coat, a sharp black Italian suit, a motorcycle jacket that read "Die in Hell" on the back, a velour tracksuit, a breakaway plaster leg cast, a short barrel Mossberg 590, and two black Para 45s. For today, he was dressed in a tweed sport coat, casual slacks, and brown lace-up shoes.
Finally, he laid three photos out on the bed. First, the guy, Frank Burnett, 51, fit, ex-Marine. The guy's daughter, Alex, early 30s, a lawyer. The guy's grandson, Jamie, now 8. The old guy had vanished, and Vasco saw no reason to bother finding him. Burnett could be anywhere in the world, Mexico, Costa Rica, Australia. Much easier to get the cells directly from other family members. He looked at the photo of the daughter, Alex, a lawyer, never good as a target. Even if you handled them perfect, you still got sued. This gal was blonde, looked to be in decent physical shape, attractive enough if you liked the type. She was too skinny for Vasco's taste. And she probably took some Israeli defense class on weekends, you never knew. Anyway, she spelled potential trouble. That left the kid. Jamie, 8 years old, second grade, local school. Vasco could get down there, pick him up, collect the samples, and be done with this whole thing by the afternoon, which was fine with him. Vasco had a $50,000 completion bonus if he recovered in the first week. That declined to $10,000 after 4 weeks, so he had plenty of reason to get it over with. Do the kid, he thought. Simple and to the point. Dolly came in, the paper in her hand. Today she was wearing a navy blue suit, low shoes, white shirt. She had a brown leather briefcase. As usual, her bland looks enabled her to move about without attracting notice. "How does this look?" she said, and handed him the paper. He scanned it quickly. It was a To Whom It May Concern, signed by Alex Burnett, allowing the bearer to pick up her son, Jamie, from school and take him to the family doctor for his exam.
"You called the doctor's office?" Vasco said.
"Yeah," said Jamie had a fever and sore throat, and they said bring him in.
"So if the school calls the doctor, we're covered."
"And you're sent from the mother's office?"
"Right."
"Got your card?" She pulled out a business card with the logo of the law firm.
"And if they call the mother?"
"Her cell number is listed on the paper, as you see."
"And that's Cindy?"
"Yes." Cindy was their office dispatcher in Playa del Rey.
"Okay, let's get it done,"
Vasco said. He put his arm around her shoulder.
"You going to be okay doing this?"
"Sure, why not?"
"You know why not."
Dolly had a weakness for kids. Whenever she looked in their eyes, she melted. They'd had a fugitive in Canada, ran him down in Vancouver. The kid answered the door, and Dolly asked if her father was home. The kid was a little girl, about 8. She said, "No, not there." Dolly said, "Okay," and left. Meanwhile, the guy was driving up the street on his way home. His darling kid shut the door, went to the phone, called her old man, and told him to keep going. The kid was experienced. They'd been on the run since she was 5. They never got close to the guy again.
"That was just one time," Dolly said. "There's been more than one.
Vasco," she said, "everything's going to be fine today."
"Okay,"
he said, and he let her kiss him on the cheek. Out in the driveway, the ambulance was parked, rear doors open. Vasco smelled cigarette smoke. He went around to the back. Nick was sitting there in a white lab coat, smoking.
"Jesus, Nick, what are you doing?"
"Just one," Nick said.
"Put it out," Vasco said. "We're heading off now. You got the stuff?"
"I do." Nick Ramsey was the doc they used on jobs when they needed a doc. He'd worked in emergency rooms until his drug and alcohol habit took over. He was out of rehab now, but steady employment was hard to come by.
"They want liver and spleen punch biopsies, and they want blood..."
"I read it. Fine needle aspirations. I'm ready." Vasco paused.
"You been drinking, Nick?"
"No. Shit, no."
"I smell something on your breath."
"No. No, come on, Vasco. You know I wouldn't..."
"I got a good nose, Nick."
"No."
"Open your mouth."
Vasco leaned forward and sniffed.
"I just had a taste, is all," Nick said.
Vasco held out his hand.
"Bottle."
Nick reached under the gurney.
handed him a pint bottle of Jack Daniels.
That's great.
Vasco moved close, got in his face. Now listen to me, he said quietly. You pull any more stunts today, and I'll personally throw you out the back of this ambulance onto the 405. You want to make a tragedy of your life? I'll see that it happens. You got me?
Yeah, Vasco.
Good. I'm glad we have an understanding. He stepped back. Hold out your hands.
I'm fine.
Hold out your hands. Vasco never raised his voice in moments of tension. He lowered it. Make them listen. Make them worry. Hold your hands out now, Nick. Nick Ramsey held out his hands. They weren't shaking. Okay. Get in the car. Get in the car, Nick. I'm through talking. Vasco got in the front with Dolly and started driving. Dolly said, He okay back there?
More or less.
He won't hurt the kid, right?
Nah, Vasco said. It's just a couple of needles. A few seconds is all.
He better not hurt that kid.
Hey,
Vasco said. Are you fine about this or what?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, then. Let's do it. He drove down the road. Brad Gordon had a bad feeling as he walked into the Border Cafe on Ventura Boulevard and looked at the booths. The place was a greasy spoon filled with actors. A guy waved from a rear booth. Brad walked back to him. The guy was wearing a light gray suit. He was short and balding and looked unsure of himself. His handshake was weak.
Willie Johnson, he said, I'm your new attorney for the upcoming trial.
I thought my uncle, Jack Watson, was providing the attorney.
He is, Johnson said. I'm he. Pederasty is my specialty.
What's that mean?
Sex with a boy, but I have experience with any underage partner.
I didn't have sex with anybody, Brad said. Underage or not?
I've reviewed your file and the police reports, Johnson said, pulling out a legal pad. I think we have several avenues for your defense.
What about the girl?
She is not available. She left the country. Her mother is ill in the Philippines, but I am told she will return for the trial.
I thought there wasn't going to be a trial, Brad said. The waitress came over. He waved her away. Why are we meeting here?
I have to be in court in Van Nuys at 10. I thought this would be convenient.
Brad looked around uneasily. Places full of people. Actors. They talk a lot.
We won't discuss the details of the case, Johnson said, but I want to lay out the structure of your defense. In your case, I am proposing a genetic defense.
Genetic defense? What's that mean?
People with various genetic abnormalities find themselves helpless to suppress certain impulses, Johnson said. That makes them, in technical terms, not guilty. We will be proposing that as the explanation in your case.
What genetic disorder? I don't have any genetic disorder.
Hey, it's not a bad thing, Johnson said. Think of it as a type of diabetes. You're not responsible for it. You were born that way. In your case, you have an irresistible impulse to engage in sex with attractive young women.
He smiled.
It's an impulse that's shared by about 90% of the adult male population.
What kind of a fucking defense is that? Brad Gordon said.
A very effective one.
Johnson shuffled through papers in a folder.
There have been several recent newspaper reports.
You mean to tell me, Brad said, that there's a gene for sex with young girls?
Johnson sighed. I wish it were that simple. Unfortunately, no.
Then what's the defense?
D4DR.
Which is?
It's called the novelty gene. It's the gene that drives us to take risks. engage in thrill-seeking behavior, we will argue that the novelty gene inside your body drove you to risky behavior. Sounds like bullshit to me.
Is it?
Let's see. Ever jump out of an airplane?
Yeah, in the army. Hated it.
Scuba diving?
Couple of times. Had a hot girlfriend who liked it.
Mountain climbing?
Nope.
Really? Didn't your high school class climb Mount Rainier?
Yeah, but that was...
You climbed a major American peak,
Johnson said, nodding.
Driving sports cars fast?
Not really, no.
You have 5 tickets for speeding in your Porsche in the last 3 years. Under California law, you've been at risk for losing your license all that time.
Just normal speeding?
I think not. How about sex with the boss's girlfriend?
Well,
and sex with the boss's wife?
Just once, a couple of jobs back, but she was the one who came on to...
Those are risky sex partners, Mr. Gordon. Any jury would agree. How about unprotected sex? Venereal diseases?
Just a minute here, Brad said.
I don't want to get into...
I'm sure you don't,
Johnson said.
And that's not surprising, considering 3 cases of pediculosis pubis, crabs, 2 episodes of gonorrhea, 1 of chlamydia, 2 episodes of condyloma or genital warts, including 1 near the anus. And that's just the last 5 years, according to the records of your doctor in Southern California.
How'd you get those?
Johnson shrugged.
Skydiving, scuba diving, mountain climbing, reckless driving, high-risk sex partners, unprotected sex? If that doesn't comprise a pattern of high-risk, thrill-seeking behavior, I don't know what does.